This is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you've got to be militant to achieve your aims and your aspirations, so be it.
There's a real hypocrisy from the big corporations.
The people from below will push for real change.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
Welcome to the Indie Media Show on RTR FM 92.1, the last Indie Media Show for 2021. But before we get into that, up first, a huge thank you to Jeff for his last edition of On the Record for this year. It's been an absolute pleasure having him, you know, bring you On the Record every Monday here on RTR this year, and look forward to him being back next week. I'm so used to saying being back next week. But there will be On the Record all throughout this week before everyone takes a bit of a holiday for a few weeks over the Christmas break. But, yeah, as I said, this is the last edition of Indie Media for the year. Also, thanks to Michaela for the news. She'll be back at 12 o'clock. A bit of a relaxed edition this week. We are going to catch up with regular, you know, presenter, contributor Alex Wisson. As, you know, despite the fact that it is this time of year where everyone's starting to wind down, there are still very serious things happening in the world, particularly around the Ukraine-Russian border. So we're going to be hearing from Alex a little later in the show. Vladimir Putin has warned NATO countries that deploying weapons or soldiers to Ukraine would cross a red line for Russia and could trigger a strong response, including a potential deployment of Russian missiles targeting Europe. Tensions have soared following the build-up of nearly 100,000 Russian troops, as well as tanks, artillery, and even short-range ballistic missiles within striking distance of Ukraine's borders. So a little later in the show, we're going to be hearing from Alex about what it all means, essentially, this kind of worrying development in in Ukraine and Russia. But mostly today, we're just going to play a few tunes, keep it pretty relaxed, and ease you into the holiday season. Up first, we're going to take a track from ModCon. This is off their recent Modern Condition release. This is Electric Whip. You're on the Indie Media Show on RTR FM 92.1. And you're on the Indie Media Show on RTR FM 92.1. A bit of a relaxed edition of the program this morning. We just heard from Tenariwen there with a track, Nonoflay, and that followed on from ModCon with their track Electric Whip off their recent Modern Condition release. A few more tracks for you, and then soon we're going to catch up with Indie Media's Alex Wisson to talk about what's happening on the border between Ukraine and Russia. But right now, here is the Public Opinion Afro Orchestra with a track from their Naming and Blaming release. This is No Passport on RTR FM at 92.1. Blacklicious on RTR FM 92.1 with a track, Lyric Fathom, taking you back 20-odd years with some hip-hop on the Indie Media Show, and that followed on from the Public Opinion Afro Orchestra with their track, No Passport. The Indie Media Show on RTR FM 92.1. My name is Raymond Grenfell. Now, tensions are escalating in the Ukraine and Russia. Vladimir Putin has warned NATO countries that deploying weapons or soldiers to Ukraine would cross a red line for Russia and even potentially trigger a strong response, including potential deployment of Russian missiles targeting Europe. It's a rather tense and I guess somewhat complicated situation. So to unpack it all, we're joined on the line by regular Indie Media contributor, presenter, Mr. Alex Martin Wisson. How are we, Alex?
Yeah, well, thanks, Ray. And as you say, it is a complicated situation on the borders of eastern Ukraine. The mainstream journalist Stan Grant wrote an article for ABC News the other day, and he said that the current geopolitical moment feels very much like we're back to the 1980s. We're seeing tensions rising with China over the South China Sea and Taiwan, and talk of diplomatic boycott of the Beijing Winter Olympics. And we're also seeing saber rattling with Russia. So in many ways, it does feel like a recapitulation of the Second Cold War of the 1980s. And typically of the mainstream press, we're only seeing one side of the story, and we're here at the Indie Media Show to give a more rounded view of what is actually happening. It's worthwhile taking a step back to contextualise the present geopolitical tensions between the United States and Russia. And one useful starting point is the so-called Euromaidan protests of 2014, which we did, I believe, cover at the time on the show. A brief recap of what those protests were about. Beginning in November 2013, there were large and widespread demonstrations against the then incumbent government of Viktor Yanukovych, who was seen as being allied with Moscow. He was eventually toppled after months of demonstrations and was forced to flee into exile in Russia, where he currently still resides to the current day. Now, those protests were very heterogeneous, multifaceted in terms of their political composition, but and most notably and controversially, they included far-right elements, including the right sector and Svoboda, and out-and-out fascists, anti-Roma bigots, anti-Semitic bigots, people who have assaulted and indeed murdered their political opponents, including opponents on the left. And they, by no means the major component necessarily of those protests, but certainly a significant element of them, something that was brought to the attention of the Western press by the Russian government at the time. Now, it's worth noting as well, and this was barely mentioned at the time of the protests, they were characterised as simply a pro-democracy protest, and it's certainly true that the Yanukovych government was deeply corrupt, true of every Ukrainian post-independence government since the early 1990s, and I'm not here to defend Viktor Yanukovych and his clientelist operations in Ukraine, but who was he replaced by? It's worth going into a little bit of detail. He was replaced as president by a man named Petro Poroshenko, a billionaire who owned a TV station and who was known among the Ukrainian population as the Chocolate King because he owned the largest confectionery company in Ukraine. And he was also known to be deeply, deeply corrupt, and which is the means by which he became a billionaire in the first place. So in other words, one corrupt oligarch who happened to be pro-Russian was replaced by another corrupt oligarch who happened to be pro-Western. And one of the things that also wasn't covered at the time is that this wasn't simply a pro-democracy protest. One of the demands of the protest was for a successor government to Yanukovych to sign the Ukrainian-European Association Agreement, which is seen as a precursor or a preliminary step to Ukraine eventually joining the European Union, possibly sometime this decade. And Yanukovych had also refused to sign the Deep and Comprehensive Free Trade Area Agreement, which is also part of enmeshing Ukrainian foreign relations into the wider European Union. And we've seen mention of this in recent times, that as sort of as the backdrop or the foreshadowing of what's really happening with all the saber rattling on the border with the Russian troop buildup, is really what this is really about is Ukraine's ascension to the European Union. Now, why is that significant? That is significant because part and parcel of joining the European Union, or certainly what some more honest Western commentators, and certainly what the Russian government is concerned about, is that will be one step up as part of actually joining the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. In other words, you would have a fully badged, paid-up member, if you like, of the Western Military Alliance right on the border with Russia. And bear in mind that many of the surrounding countries in Eastern Europe are already NATO member states, including Bulgaria, the Czech Republic, Poland, the Baltic states, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. And they are all very much, if you just have to take out a map to see that they're either contiguous with or very close to the border with Russia. And of course, Ukraine itself is literally on the border with Russia. And it has an extra layer of significance in that if you look at the Black Sea, Sevastopol is, of course, home to the Black Sea Fleet, which is the primary means for Russia's Blue Water Navy to gain access to international waters, to police its borders, to defend its maritime territory. So By way of analogy, one might imagine a Russian warships, Russian warships trying to lay claim to not necessarily the port of San Diego, but the waters off California. Imagine if there was an island, you know, say a couple hundred kilometres off the coast of California, and Russia either stationed its warships there or had a key regional ally stationing its warships there. This is the kind of level of threat that is being posed towards Russia. And yet we see the Western press coverage is a gross distortion of the reality of what's happened. So all of the talk, almost uniformly in the Western press, is of Russian aggression, is of the mobilization of some 80,000 soldiers in encampments on the Russian border. And again, you know, let's stress that I'm not here to defend the Putin government, and Russia has its own geopolitical ambitions in its own backyard. Eastern Europe has historically been comparable to South America as kind of its own backyard. But, you know, we're all in favour of sovereign independence of those East European states, and don't advocate some kind of recapitulation of the old Russian Empire by any means. But all of this is by way to mention that the Russian motivations in this situation are perfectly understandable, that there is a palpable, real, concrete threat on their borders. And in fact, recently, just in September, the United States resupplied heavy weaponry to the Ukrainian armed forces. And there were reports, because of the actual conflict in eastern Ukraine, there is a continuing low-level war in eastern Ukraine that emerged from those 2014 protests between separatists in Luhansk and Donetsk, backed by the Russians against the Ukrainian armed forces, as well as allied militias, including fascist militias like the Azov Battalion. That war that is simmering away in eastern Ukraine, one of the reasons it's actually picked up a gear in recent months is because of this American supply of heavy weaponry, including Javelin shoulder-launched portable missiles, and other heavy weaponry. And not only that, there was a lot of talk of Russian military build-up on the border, but again, virtually no mention of the fact that as recently as September, there was NATO military exercises on the territory of Ukraine, the Rapid Trident 2021 exercises involving some 4,000 Ukrainian soldiers and 2,000 NATO troops. And there has been an American brigade combat unit stationed in Ukraine in April. That's part of a multinational training force. So there's an ongoing commitment of the United States to train, arm, supply, and assist the Ukrainian armed forces in its war with Russian proxy militias in the east of the country. So all of this paints a picture of outright aggression by the United States through military training exercises, through military supply, through pretty much an open declaration of the desire to see Ukraine join the European Union and NATO, despite you know, protestations to the contrary, and as well, there are missile batteries, American missile batteries, stationed in Poland and the Czech Republic, and a six-year-old can understand the nation that those missile batteries are directed towards. They're not there for fun. They're not there for display. They're there as an openly offensive stance against Russia. So all of this paints a picture of Russia essentially being in a defensive position. And I think part of the whole story here, and it kind of in a funny sort of way, relates to the discussion we had with Paddy Gibson last week about the anti-vaccination protests, is that it tells a tale of the media. And it tells a tale of even the so-called left-wing media. So if you look at the ABC News, from ABC News right all the way through to Sky News, there is one narrative being told. One story being told, and the coverage is so biased and so narrow, it might as well have been lifted directly from a Pentagon press release. And in fact, I suspect that a lot of the coverage has literally been lifted from Pentagon press releases. So when you see stories that say official sources say, Pentagon sources say, 9 times out of 10, what that means is that the article has, for all intents and purposes, been written, or might as well have been written, by a Pentagon official. So we're seeing both commercial media and the Australian state media in lockstep with the United States, and in lockstep with a very dangerous offensive military agenda that may yet see war on Ukraine. Not necessarily, I think it's extremely unlikely that there'd be a direct conflict between Russia and the United States. Biden has threatened economic sanctions. because he knows that conventional, even conventional arms, you know, a conflict in eastern Ukraine would be disastrous not only for Russia but also for the United States, given Russia's, you know, very formidable conventional arms you know, configuration. So that's some of the facts that I think are relevant to you know, filling in the gaps in the context that is sorely lacking in the Western press coverage. And it's also a good example, I think, as well, just changing tack for a moment, in terms of the way we, broadly speaking, on the left, ought to view these sorts of conflicts, that we are not in the camp of the Russians and we're not in the camp of the United States, but what we are in favour of doing is actually, at least as a starting point, giving a full picture and an honest analysis of the situation, and not falling in behind lockstep, you know, behind our own government, which supports the United States in, as I say, a very dangerous geopolitical game in Eastern Europe that may yet get out of hand if we're not too careful.
Alex Wisson, Indie Media's regular contributor and reporter there. Alex, before I let you go, though, I'm sure you know our listeners are absolutely loving hearing you rant on there about the unfolding situation in Ukraine and Russia. But just quickly, I just wanted to ask you on a different subject. Of course, many of our listeners will be aware that the a British court has ruled in favour of the US government's appeal to extradite WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to face criminal charges in the United States. Obviously, a different subject to what we've just been discussing, but still in the realm of you know, US imperialism. Can I just get your thoughts on that, and what does it mean for Assange and for the, I guess, the developing case and his situation?
Well, it's not an entirely you know, left field connection that you're making there, because it's directly relevant, I think, in terms of truth telling about American imperialism and its the expansionist adventures and murderous adventures throughout the world. And as we know, Julian Assange, well, I mean, I regard him as a hero, and people can call in and complain if they like, but that's, I think, the empirical record stands up to describing him in such a way. You know, the collateral collateral murder videos, the Afghanistan war crimes videos, the murder of journalists, it's set all kinds of documents that he released to the world and are invaluable in terms of our understanding of American crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan and throughout the wider Middle East and North African region, and indeed in other parts of the world. And I think his case is an exemplar for the United States. They want to see him punished and spend the rest of his life in jail. And it seems that that's what now will happen. I mean, it was a surprise when initially there was a UK court that found he ought not be extradited, but that finding was, decision was made on quite narrow grounds, that he would, that his life would be under threat and that he would be a risk of suicide there. An appeals court has rejected that and said that he would not commit suicide in the United States jail. But as far as I'm aware, haven't read the finding in its entirety, but there's no compelling evidence that judge provided to say why suddenly he would not commit suicide when the finding was that he would only a few months ago. So I think we can sort of read between the lines that this is the British establishment, again, similar to the Australian government, standing you know, hand in glove with US bidding. I think it was always inevitable that the British legal system would find in favour of the extradition request. And we'll see what happened here. I must admit, I'm not up to speed in terms of the legal technicalities of whether there are further grounds for appeal. I think that there are some grounds, at least on human rights, grounds to appeal further. So it's not necessarily the end of the story. But suffice it to say that I think the damage has already been done. Julian Assange had a stroke recently. I mean, think about that for a minute. This is a man who I think is still in his late 40s. He had a stroke. All the reports are indicating that he's in very ill health indeed, and he may not have long to live. And so the damage has already been done. This is a man whose life has been destroyed by the United States, and it sends a chill down the spine of any journalist hoping to emulate his example. And we've seen, of course, similar examples in Australia with some ABC journalists and Fairfax journalists reporting SAS murders in Afghanistan. We've seen the way they were treated. They were actually defended quite well, at least in the case of the ABC. And even Fairfax, it has to be said, have defended their journalists reasonably well. And so they are going to, you know, avoid jail time. Because I think I think there's a lot of willful denial about the reality of the Assange case. But, oh, it would never happen here. And, you know, so Australian journalists would never be jailed, would never be treated in a similar way. But I think the experience of those journalists covering SAS crimes in Afghanistan, you know, ought to be a warning to people that, in fact, it can happen here, because they were not too far away from being prosecuted in the court and going to jail. So there's a threat to all journalists everywhere. And if you think, even as an Australian journalist, that you're safe from, you know, the US threats of prosecution and jail time, clearly the case of Julian Assange proves otherwise.
Alex Wisson, indie media presenter, reporter, they're talking to us a bit about, about the Assange case and the news that a British court has ruled in favour of the US government's appeal to extradite WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to face criminal charges in the US, and also previously discussing the unfolding situation on the border between Ukraine and Russia. Thanks very much for speaking to us this morning, Alex.
Yeah, my pleasure.
And this is the Indie Media Show on RTRFM 92.1, the very last show for the year. Going to play a few more tracks and have a bit more news. And then we're going to hand you over to the very capable and excellent hands of Rianne Todhunter. He's going to take you out to lunch at 12 o'clock. But right now, here is Body Type with Insomnia. Body Type on RTRFM 92.1 with their track Insomnia. And this is the Indie Media Show with myself, Raymond Grenfell. Brahma is also in the studio. It's our last program for the year, so we're keeping things pretty chill. But I've got a bit of time for some indie media news. Filipino journalist Jesus Jess Malabanan was shot dead Wednesday by unknown assailants. 58-year-old Malabanan reported for a number of outlets, including Reuters, where he worked on their coverage of Filipino President Rodrigo Duterte's deadly war on drugs. The reporting won a 2018 Pulitzer Prize. Rights groups say dangers facing journalists have increased under Duterte. The National Union of Journalists of the Philippines found 21 media workers have been killed since Duterte took office. And in the United States, in New York, environmental and human rights lawyer Stephen Donziga has been sent home under a pandemic-related early release program to serve the rest of his six-month prison sentence from his apartment. Donziga was sentenced in October for contempt of court after a corporate prosecutor tied to the oil and gas industry went after him for successfully taking on Chevron on behalf of indigenous groups in the Ecuadorian Amazon, whose land and water were contaminated by the oil giant. International rights groups and a number of US lawmakers have called for his release. Donziga, who had already spent over 2 years under house arrest before his prison sentence, vowed to continue fighting for his freedom and to hold Chevron accountable for its crimes. And in related Ecuadorian news, in a landmark ruling last week, Ecuador's Constitutional Court said plans to mine for copper and gold in a protected cloud forest were unconstitutional and violate the rights of nature. The case involved mining permits that were issued in Los Cedros, a protected area in northwestern Ecuador, which the High Court argued would harm the precious and unique biodiversity of the forest. The rights of nature are enshrined in Ecuador's constitution. In Morocco, occupied Western Sahara, renowned Sahrawi human rights defender Sultana Kaya and her sister Laura were attacked and sexually assaulted during a night raid on December 5th by dozens of masked agents belonging to the Moroccan security forces, who have held the family under house arrest for over 1 year in the city of Bojur. Sultana Kaya says agents stole mobile phones, threw trash, urine and noxious black liquid into her family's drinking water storage tank and destroyed what was left of the family's belongings. And Chile has legalized same-sex marriage after years of organizing and political pressure. The legislation also recognizes adoption and other parental rights of same-sex couples and full spousal benefits. The historic vote came as Chileans prepare to cast ballots in a presidential runoff on December 19. The race pits progressive former student activist Gabriel Boric against far-right José Antonio Kast, who has opposed LGBTQI rights during his time as a lawmaker. And Rohingya refugees are suing Facebook's parent company Meta over its failure to stop violent hate speech on its platform, which contributed to the bloody military crackdown of the Rohingya Muslim community by the Burmese junta in 2017. Law firms in the US and UK launched the legal effort on behalf of the Rohingya community around the world, including in Bangladeshi refugee camps. Plaintiffs are demanding over $150 billion in damages. The UN found as many as 10,000 Rohingya were killed by Burmese forces during the 2017 genocide, though some estimates put the death toll at much more than twice that number. Another 730,000 people were forced to flee the country. And that's about all we have time for on this week's edition of the Indie Media Show. As I said, this is the last edition of the program for this year, but of course we'll be back next year on about the 10th of January. It's our first show back, bringing you all the other news and interviews every week for 2022. Keep it locked, though, as Rian Todhunter is taking you out to lunch shortly, and there's all other great things happening throughout the day on RTI. You should just have it on all the time. Have a great Christmas break, if that's what you do. Enjoy yourselves, and we'll see you in 2022. Going to leave you with a track from Gorgo Bordello. This is his single, Walking on the Burning Coal. But as we say every week on Indie Media, don't hate the media, become the media.